Welcome to Voices of Today, a podcast for the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra. 8 years ago, we were thrilled to hear the debut of Jennifer Higdon's Harp Concerto with the RPO. Well, the thrill is back. Jennifer has composed a cello concerto for the Voices of Today initiative, and she's here to talk about it and more. Welcome back, Jennifer.
Oh, it's good to be back. Rochester is a favorite memory from my past, and it doesn't even feel like it was 8 years ago. Is that? I can't believe it's been that long, but I guess there was a pandemic somewhere in the middle there, so.
Yeah, that wiped out many people's memories.
Yeah, mine included, yeah.
So when you get a commission, Jennifer, where does it begin?
Oh, that's a good question. The most important thing, I think, is talking to the soloist or whoever is going to be featured, and finding out what they would like and what pieces of standard repertoire they like. Are there things that they like to do? Are there things they don't want to do? Most musicians don't want to improvise basically a cadenza. Although I found that percussionists through the years love to improvise cadenzas, but you just try to figure out what might suit that individual, that instrument, because you know that it hopefully it goes beyond the premiere, and you want to kind of add to the repertoire. There's so much for the cello. This was an interesting thing. When I did my harp concerto, there wasn't like tons of repertoire in the same way that a cellist has incredible repertoire for basically a concerto format. It can be daunting. So I study a lot of the other concertos to see what people do and try to figure out, is there something I can do different, or how can I kind of contribute to the genre?
Was Julian the pick from the get-go?
Oh, yes. I think, if I remember correctly, he was literally the start of the project. I remember I was down at University of Miami Frost School. I was down there. They had been a co-commissioner on another concerto, one for two percussionists. And because they were a co-commissioner, his dad, George Schwartz, was conducting the performance down there. So he and I had some time to talk, and he said, would you ever consider writing a cello concerto for Julian? And I was like, absolutely. I mean, I've been asked, cellists have been saying, when are you going to write a cello concerto? So it felt like the right time. Basically. So I said, yeah, I'd be game. So, but it really did kind of start with Julian. I know he talks a lot to his dad, that they have a great working relationship. And so that was kind of the very beginning of it.
Did you sit down with Julian and listen to him play, to sort of hear what he does?
You know, this was unusual. We both had a really bad schedule. So what I ended up doing, he sent me a bunch of recordings and I watched videos of him. I felt like I knew his playing. I mean, we know so many of the same musicians, and I had listened to the repertoire he had recorded, repertoire that he had performed in the most recent years, the various concerti. He knew my piece, my first piano trio. He was talking about that, but I kind of got a sense talking to him on the phone and watching video and listening to him. It gave me a really good sense of his playing, and kind of he has a lot of soul in his playing. That was one of the things that struck me. You can feel it. It sounds weird, and it's a hard thing to explain in words, but it's just something you kind of feel on a gut level. And to me, that's the way I think about composing. So it seemed like an automatic, immediate connection. And what I did to make sure this was working, because his schedule was really busy. I think when we first started talking, I think he was getting ready to have his first child. And he was also playing a lot, and I was traveling a lot for concerts. It was kind of an insane sort of schedule snafu, but I wrote one of the movements and sent it to him before I did anything else. And it was the longest movement in the piece, kind of what I consider the heart. Sometimes the middle of it is the heart. And I sent it to him with a piano reduction, because I knew his wife would play with him. You know, they'd sit down and play it together, and I think he wrote back within 24 hours and said, oh my gosh, you've totally captured my playing. And, you know, that's inspiration for any composer to hear that kind of thing.
So you started with the middle and then you worked out. Is that first note, for the first note of the first piece,
yeah,
is that the hardest thing to find where to begin?
Oh, it's always hard. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I write movements and I'm not exactly sure where they're going to fit. Like sometimes I'll have an idea and I'll write the idea out, and then I work to kind of expand that idea, and I'm not always positive where it'll be. I thought this was going to be a three movement work, but it turned out to be four movements. That was the thing that after doing that big movement, I thought, okay, what's a good form? What will leave people enthusiastic about the instrument, but also show off what Julian can do? So by the time I got to the end of that one movement, I realized it would be a middle movement, but there were going to be four movements. But the other three movements would not be as long. So I often think about things like duration because you think about people's attention. But you have to admit, when you first start pieces, it takes weeks to find the kind of the pacing and the I don't know, the colors or something. I mean, it's like feeling around in the dark.
Have you ever started something and said, this isn't right for this piece, so I'm just going to like put it over in a little box over there and maybe I'll
Yeah,
get back to that?
absolutely. I have done that before. And sometimes I don't know what the piece, whatever I sketched, I don't know where it's going to fit, but at some point in the future, it may even be years down the road. It has been years before. Something will pop up and say, hey, remember that little thing you wrote down? So it's interesting in this concerto, everything felt like it belonged straight out of the box. I mean, it was pretty obvious that everything felt like it was there. I thought I wrote the piece over 3 months, which is actually a kind of a quicker write for a full scale concerto of this size. This piece is like 25, 26 minutes, so it's got a lot of notes, but it really for it to be in 3 months, but you can tell that it felt right. And sometimes when you're writing, you're doing anything creative, if it feels right, you know to get the notes down and just hang on and wait to see if anything pokes back at you. It's like a little wild animal in a box somewhere. So it's kind of interesting. It's mysterious though, Julia. That's the really weird thing about it. I find after all these years, decades of composing, I still am shocked by the mystery, the amount of mystery that exists there.
It's mysterious for you. It's mysterious for us. I mean, for me, composing is alchemy. I have no idea. I have no idea how you go about doing what you do. And so how do you go about doing what you do? Do you have a specific like room you like to work in, light that you like to have around you at time of day?
Yeah, I try to write every day because I'm going through a real spate here of a lot of composing. In fact, when this concerto premieres, it'll be my sixth premiere out of seven that started last week here with me in yeah, so I've got seven in a row, which is a lot. So I've been writing a lot of music. So I tend to write every day. I always try to write at the very beginning of the day because you wake up, you eat breakfast, if you work out, you come sit down and the ideas are the freshest. You don't have all the noise of the day, the emails and stuff like that. But I'm now living in North Carolina. I think when I wrote the harp concerto, I was in Philadelphia, and it's been surprising. It's like I've got nature out my back window. I'm in my studio now, and I feel like the ideas are coming through a little more clearly, like I have better radio reception or something. And when I'm writing these pieces, I have a one blank notebook that's a kind of a sketch notebook that artists use for sketching, where I just write words down. Because I'm trying to figure out titles and some sort of logic to the piece or ideas for sounds. And then I also have a manuscript notebook that I'm writing, checking things out harmonically or some cool melody I think about, and I make notations in that. And then I have the computer where I also have blank sketch pads on there as well. So there's a lot of sketching that goes into it. And I write in a reduced piano form. It's not really a piano form. It's got like eight staves with a cello on the top. So it's what we call a short score. So it doesn't make all the decisions about how you orchestrate something, who's going to play what part, but it does allow you to kind of get the harmonies and inner lines down.
All right, you brought it up. How do you orchestrate something? How do you figure out who's going to play which part?
Yeah, it's a really good question. You have to have a very active imagination. And I think all the years for me of looking at scores, also sitting in the orchestra and playing and watching rehearsals, a lot of times when I was at Curtis as a student and even as a faculty member, I'd go in if someone was coming in. I remember Ozma Vanska coming in to actually read some stuff with the orchestra. I got a score of the music and I followed along. But my thought always with these concertos is to write a lot of interesting parts for the orchestra itself. And that's a new thing basically in the 21st century, into the 20th century. People always just wrote simple accompaniments and the soloist played over the top. But I love the interaction between the soloist and people within the orchestra so that you almost have like chamber music that's encased in an orchestra. So I try to figure out how to vary the colors the most. And I have to be careful about certain things because you don't want too many brass. And if they're playing all the time, that's hard for them, but it also absorbs the color of the cello. So you have to keep everyone out of the way of the soloist. You think about the color of that instrument that you're featuring, in this case, the cello, which has a great, rich, low sound and an extraordinary singing high sound. But you want to make sure you're not using instruments in the orchestra simultaneous to the soloists being in those ranges, because it's as if you were painting a canvas and you put a whole bunch of yellows and reds and pinks at the top. And if I need Julian to stand out at the top, I need to change the colors up there. I need to use a darker color because he's very bright. So I literally think a little bit like a painter does. How do I draw the audience's ear to what he is doing? Give contrasting material and supporting material, and let the players in the orchestra also kind of play chamber music with him. So it's a big guessing game, to be quite honest. Over the years, I've gotten better at guessing, but you do have to kind of like be ready when you start rehearsals to change things quickly if something's not working, because inevitably there's something that you've miscalculated.
So when you bring a piece to an orchestra, you're ready to do that. I mean, some composers say, no, this is it, you're done. But you actually will listen and say, okay, maybe we'll make that an F sharp.
Yeah, absolutely. And I may say, oh, I've got too many people playing here. Let's take this down to three players. Or, I mean, I literally will change the dynamics. Sometimes I'll take out some of the lines that are moving. So it's not unusual. And you basically, as a composer, you work very fast because you don't have a lot of rehearsals. So you make lists on a legal pad. And then I frequently go back to the hotel, make a list of changes. I change all the parts and I send the new versions of the parts to the librarian overnight. So I don't get to go to sleep until I get those changes in because the musicians have a big job in learning this, and so they need that those changes as quickly as possible. So it's kind of learning to paint with sound and make quick judgments and keep your fingers crossed that they work.
Now, when you have a lot of commissions stacked up, so you just said you have like seven in a row, and you're writing all these pieces, how do you keep from plagiarizing yourself? How do you keep each piece fresh from the other pieces?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think sometimes there is overlap in the pieces. For instance, I know in this cello concerto, I got to the end and there was this one chord progression I heard in my head and I thought, I wonder if Julian can play that. So I sent him a little PDF of this. I said, this is the tempo. Can you play these triple stops and these quadruple stops? Can you do it? And he responded immediately and said, oh yeah, no problem. And the gesture was so bold, I thought, oh, you know, this would be perfect for the next piece I'm writing. Maybe I should make a little piece of this kind of this gesture and put it in the new piece and write around that and create a new piece with it, which I did. So it's kind of sometimes you pull things from other places. The first movement of this concerto, actually, some of the music came from another piece that I was working on with a poet who I was setting her. She had this amazing poem, and there was this one line in the poem, if I told you how I read your dream with a cello, which I was very intrigued. I'm like, read your dream with a cello. How do I read your dream with a cello? So I thought, all right, let's go back to that line. Let me see if I can create some music that would kind of portray that, read the dream with a cello. So when I did that, I realized, you know what, I should call the very first movement poet, because I always think of a cello as a poet. It's one of the instruments that has one of the widest ranges to work with as a composer. You know, it's got it because it does have that lush low end and it has the singing high end. And I thought, you know what, Julian's a poet. He, in a way, he's relaying a poem, I'm writing it, but it's also him too, you know? It's because you're showing off the player as well. And that kind of was a good jumping off point. And I remember, because I wrote the third movement as the very first thing, and it feels very earnest, I thought, I need a specific kind of word here for this. And I thought, it popped into my head. I wasn't exactly sure this is the right word, but fervent, the word fervent popped up. So I'm like looking it up in the dictionary. I'm like, is this a real word? This is a real word, right? And so that made me think, what if I gave the titles to the movements? It made it like a haiku. So I selected movement titles that sound a little bit like it could be Julian dancing through things. So it's Poet is the first movement. Dances is the second movement because it kind of moves along as a dance. The third movement, which is kind of the heart of the piece, is called Fervent. And then the last movement I called Lines because they are all lines. The whole orchestra is doing all these lines, like a little bit like they're dancing with Julian, but it's a little bit of a race to the end. And I thought Poet, Dances, Fervent, Lines. It sounds very haiku-like. So, and you know, this stuff comes to you as you're writing. You're like, ah, I can't get through this measure. This is a bad transition. And so you're sitting back kind of agonizing over what you're trying to write, where you're trying to get to. And some random idea pops into your head like, ah, dances, dances. I could have a dance movement. Yeah, I could have it. Oh, that might be good. The poet dances. What would the poet be dancing? And I thought how poets write lines. Oh, okay, one of these could be lines. So over 3 months, those ideas kind of coalesce. It's a little bit like you're flying in a plane looking at stars and clouds. The moon's the sun. But eventually all these come together to kind of tell a story. So, and how that happens, I don't know. It blows me away.
Once piece is done, are you done? Have you ever wanted to go back and say, I want to change that?
You know, sometimes I'll do a little bit of tweaking, a tiny bit. It's funny, we haven't even premiered the piece, but today as I was reviewing this piece, because I've written so much music, in order to talk to you today, I had to go back and look at my notes and think, okay, what was I thinking for that? And I found one measure in the trumpet, so I'm like, I have three notes that are wrong here. They don't sound right. So I wrote this down right before we started this taping, and I thought, okay, I'm going to actually send this to the librarian and say, can you change this measure here? I feel like somehow I found the wrong notes here. It's kind of an interesting thing, but I do occasionally go back and adjust because I learn when we put it together with real musicians, a real orchestra and a real solo. It's not just in my head. Sometimes my head miscalculates something. And I talk to the musicians, they're like, well, this would be a little bit better if you put it on this note and I can articulate this. Or so I will go back and make changes because I try to make the pieces work the best that they can so that when they move to less skilled players, which is what you hope for, that they'll be okay playing it. You're giving them enough of a roadmap, so you're trying to keep the map updated, but there will be little changes in there.
So what haven't you written for? What's on your bucket list?
Oh, boy. That's a good question. I've been writing so much music. My bucket list is like more like a nap in the summer on the porch. It's a really good question. I'm getting ready to start a piece for the Acropolis Reed Quintet, which is five reed players, which is very different than anything I've done. And then I got a flute concerto after that. Being a former flutist, I've been kind of putting this one off. So we'll see. But you know, there's probably stuff out there. I've often thought it would be nice to write new Christmas carols. I mean, talk about a really unusual challenge. But I think I'm very fortunate that I often get to write the things I want to write. Like I literally, and I've got a lot on my schedule. It's really, it's a joy. It's just a privilege. I can't even imagine that this would have been my life when I was younger as a student.
So what happened? You started this super late. Yeah. You know, you walked into, was it Bowling Green? No clue. And just said, I want to be a classical musician. How does that happen?
That's a really good question. I thought a lot about that because even when I look at the trajectory, and this, it strikes me now because I look at young composers' works and I hear what they want to do. They talk to me. And I think, how the heck did I go from knowing absolutely nothing to wanting to do this and sticking it out when people said, oh, you started too late, and then just continuing to kind of roll with it. And one of the things I think I learned early on was that you're always learning. Like, I never feel like I know what I'm doing ever. Although it's obvious my instincts have slowly developed over time, but I'm pretty sure some of this may have to do with John Williams and the very first Star Wars movie that came out back in like 1977, because that soundtrack, I was entering high school and that soundtrack came out, and I was so blown away by the power of the orchestra that it was like getting sucked down into a giant adventure tube. I'm going down this tube and I'm like, I wanna do music. I mean, literally, and I knew absolutely nothing. But the thing was, I was really good about being disciplined and getting in and asking questions of my teachers and working hard. I was always behind the other students. Always, they all knew more. They had much longer histories in music, so they knew who Beethoven was. I didn't know who Beethoven was when I went off to college, which is kind of stunning when I think about it now. But in a way, it was hard when I was going through school, but now I can go back and talk to students and say, you know what? You guys are farther along than I was at your age. And that's actually kind of a really empowering lesson for other students. I think the trick was to just stick with it and keep studying and keep trying to grow and ask questions and staying humble. You know, you have so much to learn, and at any point in time, you could completely fall on your face, which is totally a possibility. So it's a curiosity and kind of a hunger, but also seeing the joy that people derive from music in itself is an inspiration for me.
Did you find at any point that being a woman in this particular career was a bit of a stumbling block for you?
That's a really good question. I think my ignorance was more of a stumbling block, and I was paying so much attention to what I was trying to learn that I may not have thought about that. And the interesting thing is, I'm sure there were instances where people were like, ah, there's no way. And I have people now who meet me and they're like, oh, you're a lot shorter than I thought. I'm like, is it because the music sounds big? What does that mean? Does my music sound tall? I'm not tall. And people in the early days used to say to me all the time, they're like, I can't believe a woman wrote that. And I'd be like, yeah, you better believe a woman wrote that. But I also realize in this perspective that I am responsible. It is one of my responsibilities, part of my job to be at the forefront of something, to be visible, to be able to speak about it, because it also makes it possible for other women composers coming behind me. There's no doubt that there are really serious issues that are going on where women are kind of having to push against things. And I've always felt like the art should be able to speak for itself, but that doesn't always happen. But it happens more now because once you win a Grammy or a Pulitzer, people are like, oh, she must know what she's talking about. So.
Is it true that a Pulitzer and a Grammy means automatically you know what you're talking about?
No, it's not actually true, but other people think that it does. They do return your calls, though.
Which in itself is a victory right off the top.
Is.
So do you are a role model for other women, so are you conscious of that? Are you self-conscious of that?
I think if you're conscious of it, you're probably self-conscious of it in a way, but not in a negative way. I feel like it's a responsibility. So a lot of times when I go in with orchestras, I'll suggest other women composers they should look at. So it's in a way too, if I look at a season, if I go in with an orchestra and I look at what they are programming, if it's all men, I'm like, half of your audience is women. Why not give them a voice? In this experience, we need the art to survive. In order for the art to survive, it has to reflect the experience of everyone who will come into your hall to hear the performance. So that goes for conductors and soloists and composers. I'm sure there are differences in the way the women and the men make music, whether they're playing or they're conducting or they're recording or they're writing it. And it's important to kind of show that. It's amazing to me when I've been on programs with all women conductor, soloist, and myself, how many audience members are like, "Oh my gosh, this is so great. It you're all women and you're doing this." And you see the little girls, this is the thing, the young girls saying, "It's great to see someone who looks like me who's actually making music." I mean, you realize that it's more of a barrier than I think I had originally realized until audience members started saying something about it.
Your big breakthrough piece was Blue Cathedral. That was
Yeah.
really the thing that made your name. And it gets played a lot. And I've always wondered, are you at all like Bruch, who, he had that first violin concerto And then they ignored everything. And he really kind of grew to resent his violin concerto. You ever want to say to somebody, please, no, there's something other than Rue Cathedral
You
that you
know,
could play?
I have to admit I've never thought about doing that because the piece feels personal, but I also feel like the piece doesn't belong to me anymore. The fact of the matter is, in a way, it kind of belongs to the world. I mean, we're up to like 1,300 performances at this point. So, I mean, it's like every week somebody is doing it. And it's kind of moving to have a piece that moves out throughout the world like that. But a really odd side effect of this that I never thought about, but when I was in with Rochester with Yolanda Condonassis before, I found out that she decided to ask me about a harp concerto because she was standing backstage when Blue Cathedral was being done. She was getting ready to go on to play. And now I've had a couple of soloists, and they also have the same story. They're standing backstage waiting to go on for their concerto, and they hear Blue Cathedral, and they're like, oh, what's that? So I think it's probably landed me a few concerti commissions because people happen to be standing back there waiting to go on themselves. So it's kind of a miraculous thing. It's something I don't take for granted at all. And enough of my music gets played in other places. I don't ever think about, oh, maybe you should look at this, you should look at that. So I wouldn't take that piece away from anyone because I know for me it means things personally, but I also see it in other people's eyes when they come up to me, and sometimes I get letters in the mail from people who were touched by it.
Your music has an immediate and a direct hit to the heart. It would be what one would call accessible. And I read this wonderful interview with you where you said, "Well, let's pretend that no one in the room has ever heard classical music. Will this speak to them? Do you approach everything that you write like that?"
I do, actually. I do. And I think it's because I started late in music. I can remember my initial impressions when I first heard classical pieces, but I also have enough conversations with people on airplanes and airports where they say, "What do you do?" And I say, "I write music." And I know they're thinking, "Oh, it's pop music." And they're like, "What kind of music do you write?" I'm like, "Classical." And they go, "Oh." Then we have a conversation about classical music. Like a lot of times I go into a town, I'll find someone, if I'm going to a diner or something, I'll ask like the wait staff, "Do you want to come to this concert? I'll get you tickets." Because I found that a lot of people are just afraid to go in. They think they have to dress a certain way. They're worried about they won't have the right response. So I make an actual effort to try to get people in who've maybe never been to a concert before, because that's also part of my responsibility when I think about it. But I kind of understand how they're seeing it because classical music isn't as visible as, say, like Taylor Swift's documentary on her tour on Netflix. So, but the thing I also realize is people who don't normally listen to classical music, who haven't grown up around it, they tend to respond to the newer music that's more energetic because it reflects some aspect of their current lives. So they, if you can get them in the hall, a lot of times they get very excited. You're trying to kind of pull down a barrier that's holding them back. And basically the barrier is something that they just have within themselves. And it's not that hard to pull down, but trying to get as much music out into the world as you can, I feel like services all of us. It helps the industry, it helps the orchestras, and it makes it feel like this piece of art is relevant to our community.
I think it's a real shame that the Grammy Awards no longer televise classical music. It used to be, I remember seeing Miles Davis play during the Grammys. I remember seeing some wonderful pianists playing Liszt on the Grammys, and they don't do that. And that's probably the very best way to get the audiences to say, "Oh, wait, that's something. That's something really good." And they usually had the orchestra there, so come on, how hard can that be?
It's true. And now people who don't listen to classical music, their reference points are movies, any music that occurs on a commercial, or something that they might have had in their video game background. I mean, I heard Michael Tilson Thomas say this once, and I thought about it. He's right. The majority of classical music gets consumed in movies and video games. And I'm like, well, that's not, I mean, oh, okay, maybe it is. But he's right. That happens to be kind of the thing that the majority of people, how they experience it. It makes me want to tell orchestras, let's get your performances out there in front of people. It would just help in general. It would make more of the community feel like they are included in this experience because there is so much pop music around. We have to get our music out there, Julia. It's this is,
How many of us actually started listening to classical music with Looney Tunes and
Yeah,
Fantasia? I mean,
absolutely.
that was the starting point, but for so many people.
Yep.
And so in many ways, if video music is sort of going to make them go into the hall, that's not so
I
bad.
agree. I totally agree. If so long as you get them in the hall, because I think a live music experience is so captivating that I think for them, it may be enough to get them to come back. Because I know there's always, they look at these different numbers as like who returns to the hall. That's another consideration. If you come in for your first time, will you be a returning customer? And what would make you come back? So when I'm writing music, though, this is on my mind. I can work to make the music as interesting as I possibly can, because I feel like that's part of my job is also showing that new music can be friendly and it can speak to you. That not only am I standing up for women, but I'm also standing up for living composers because, in a way, we reflect our lives now, the sounds we hear in our world, the pacing, the anxieties we have, we provide solace. So if I can make the music do that through like Julian playing the cello, it's all the better for everyone. Because if you can get people enthused who maybe have never even thought to go into a concert hall, it means a lot. It can't hurt any of us. That's the thing. It's all positive.
When you finish a piece and you let it go and you send it out into the world, what is that moment like for you, Jennifer?
It's pretty cool. It's also a little scary because it's a little piece of your soul going out, and it feels your heart is going out and it feels exposed. But I've learned through the years to trust, to let go, and to understand that the music is now going into the hands of capable conductors and musicians, and you just have to let it do that and live its own life. I think it's not the same as being a parent to kids, but I do have to give it the permission. Like you try to do the best you can to get it trained to go in the right direction, and you keep your fingers crossed, and hopefully it does. So, and I'm lucky because a lot of my music goes out. I have so many performances a year. I mean, probably well over 250 performances a year. So I kind of have to let it go. Otherwise, I would never be able to sleep. So.
Jennifer, it has been a delight talking to you again, and we look forward to having you come back to Rochester with this new piece in four movements. We'll hear the poetry of Julian Schwartz playing your cello concerto. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure for me as well.
Jennifer Higdon has been chatting with me. I'm Julia Figueres. Our director is Lily Wintringham. Voices of Today is a production of the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra.